On page 21, looking ahead just a second, we're talking about does this say, you see where it says on number 3, the synthetic theory involves 3 categories? Find that. I want to see if Michelle must have been correct. First, the first edition, yeah. Which it says, abiogenesis, right? Page 21, number 3. Synthetic theory involves 3 categories. Abiogenesis, microevolution, which is, should read the special theory of evolution. It reads that way? Okay, it's been corrected. Macroevolution is the general theory. On the original edition, it got was reversed, which wouldn't make a lot of sense. And make sure I got those correct in my tradition. Now, I'm glad everybody's here today because this is one of the most important lectures on a practical way and in this whole course. So I'm going to spend a whole hour on this, and I want you to understand the concept of this topic if you have any questions. The synthetic theory we're talking about, we're on the bottom page, so this is the bottom page 20. Macroevolution, synthetic theory. Synthetic means, this is neo-Darwinism, it's a synthesis of, this is the view that, this is still in the textbook, this is textbook evolution, but it is very much questioned. I'm just now reading a very interesting book, one of the latest put out, not by creationists, questioning this theory, saying it's days are over. It's a synthesis of the neo-Darwinian concept of natural selection, and the concept of change, the raw material being through gene mutation. Mendel's work, popularized by Dobzhansky and O'Perrin, and others, that is that change is brought out through mutation, tiny mutations, upon which, this is the raw material, upon which natural selection acts. And it produces, small changes accumulate into large changes. Hence, evolution, neo-Darwinism. Now, I'll put this on the board, because I told you I'm going to put it back on the board. The concept of microevolution and macroevolution. G. Gaylor Simpson, one of the godfathers of evolution.
He's a professor at Yale and Harvard College, I forget which.
He's the author of this terminology. And we talk about the general evolution. At the popular level, we talk about the theory of evolution as it opposes creation. What is being spoken of is the general theory of evolution. It is general evolution, or it is trans-specific. Trans-specific evolution, or or macro, or large evolution, macro evolution. Sometimes called mega evolution, whether you want to use the Latin or the Greek. Now that is the theory of amoeba to man evolution, basically. And before that, before the amoeba, you have chemical evolution. When the primordial soup got struck by lightning, all these chemicals got mixed and produced. In other words, chemical evolution is the theory of abiogenesis. That is, that the basic chemicals in the primordial earth somehow got together and arranged themselves into life, monocellular life. And then general evolution is that it takes up there and brings it up to modern forms, including man. Now, but there's a distinction to be made between microevolution and by microevolution, as I said the other day, this speaks of changes within limits, within kinds.
And, now listen to me, all of the evidence for evolution is evidence of microevolution, which I talked about last time. Okay? And, therefore, the biological evidence, that is, look at the living forms, the biological evidence and the paleontological evidence which is what? What is the paleontological evidence? Fossils. This evidence is of micro. Let me look at that again.
This is about what?
This is micro. And all of the examples, this is very important, all of the examples of evolution in the textbooks is of microevolution. You got that? That is, changes within basic kind or phyla, and there is great variety. Now, and the evidence is that within the areas of microevolution, forms can change within certain limits. There's great variety, adaptation. There is adaptation. But only up to a point. And then what happens is what happens when a particular kind of biological form changes, adapts, to the extent of the genetic information contained within it. You understand that we know that within the DNA, that is, there's information there, and when the limits of that information is used, what happens? Does it break out into a form, or move over into a form where there is added or different information? The answer is no. What it does, it reverts back within itself. This is called the Hardy-Weinberg principle. It reverts back in, and you do not have, the question is, do you have transition ? The answer is no. You do not have transition. What you have is reversion. You have adaptation and reversion. Are you all understanding me? Ask me if you don't. Now, this is the evidence. The evidence is this.
Is it always the case that it reverts back? Why can't it not maintain it?
It can adapt to a certain point, but then when it gets to the limits of the information, it reverts back.
But it may be a while until.
Oh yes, that is it may not revert, but it will not. There may not be reversion, but there will not be transition. There may not be reversion, but there cannot be transition. Now, it's simply because there's not the genetic information there to allow this. That is, within, say, our famous Drosophila fruit flies, they found that there was enough genetic information there to make many more kinds of fruit flies than you started out with, but they were always fruit flies. And when they got to the end of the genetic information and tried to make something besides fruit flies, it did not work. All they got was defective fruit flies. When they left them alone, they reverted. They'd come to the extent of the genetic information. That is, God has built into the, and nobody knows exactly what all these kinds are. That's taxonomy of the present. It's very difficult. But God has built into the various biological forms, including man, sufficient genetic information to allow him to survive through adaptation. Really, it's an argument for teleology, not evolution. You got that? He has permitted the capacity within biological forms to different degrees, enough genetic information, and that is, it permits enough variety so that creatures can adapt and therefore survive. But only up to a point. The biblical principle holds, when you look at paleontology, that and biology, and that is, they shall reproduce what? After their kind. After their kind. Now, so that, and this is the fossil evidence. Is there fossil evidence of evolution? Yes, if you mean microevolution. The problem is that, there, and everyone admits this, they don't admit it in the textbooks, but they admit it in the scholarly books, that the question is, what do we find in the fossil record? Neo-Darwinism predicts a continuum. The theory predicts a continuum. But what is found is not a continuum, but a discontinuum, gaps. That is, what you find in the biological order is exactly what you find in the paleontological order, microevolution, but gaps within the kinds. Every form, every different kind of form, listen to me, not every different species, but every different kind of form appears suddenly in the fossil record without ancestry, without antecedents. Nobody really questions that. For a long time, early in this century, the promise was that these so-called missing links would be found. But nobody is saying that anymore. We just haven't looked hard enough. And of course, all kinds of theories were cooked up to try to figure out how, why the forms aren't there. Oh, the gap between micro and mega, or macro, this is macro. Now, what was, in the absence of fossil evidence, now listen to me, I'm not slinging mud at evolutionism, I'm not misrepresenting it, I'm explaining it. Do you understand that? That is, everything I say is simply taken from pro-evolution texts. This is not a preacher's tirade against the subject. I've been examining this, and I've gone over this with my professor to make sure I did not misrepresent it. It's not. There's no question about it. In fact, what I'm saying now is being pointed out by many who are trying to get a new look at the whole thing. Okay. What method, then, in the absence of fossil evidence, for instance, paleontologists will admit that there is no uncontested, there's not a single uncontested a transitional form. Now, but the theory predicts, listen to me, the theory predicts that for every form that is found, there should be an infinite number of transitional forms. It's like saying, it's not like saying out of 1,000 possible forms, we're missing 10, or 20, or 100, a tenth. It's saying out of 100 million possible forms, we're missing all but 1,000. You understand that? That's what we're looking at. It's not like, well, we've got a chain with a couple of links missing. What we've got is a couple of links and the whole chain's missing. Question?
Well, then the changes are so small and minute, they wouldn't even be able to identify a transitional form.
They should. For instance, they should be able to. For instance, if you find the form, one of the forms that always gets in the textbook is the Archaeopteryx, which is supposed to be a transition between reptiles and birds. It is not a transition. It appears outside the fossil record. It contains characteristics of modern birds, and paleontologists and biologists themselves admit that you can call it a transitional form, but there's no evidence that it's a transitional form. It's simply an extinct form.
What would be their guidelines to identify it?
Okay, take the example of between the flipper and the foot, something that was halfway, partly flipper and part foot, part fin and part foot. But they don't find, what they find is fins and feet.
It still plays that they're possibly out there, they just haven't found them?
Well, it used to. The turn of the century, they were found. For instance, take a rattlesnake. Take a rattlesnake's tooth. Hypodermic tooth. transitional plan would be a tube that was on the way to being hypodermic, but an ordinary tube. No, they find the ordinary tube and hypodermic tube. They don't find something halfway there. See what I'm saying? You recognize that song. Although, actually, it's really science fiction, because when you start describing it, they get ridiculous.
Well, what I mean is, for instance, now, when you look at our freshman student, our assignment, how they know that's not on the way to being a molar, but the molar is on the way to being excited.
Well, that's, it becomes a judgment call. But basically, well-adapted organisms or organs or forms are usually not looked on as transitional. They're already adapted. That is, it already does what it's supposed to do. But how the eye is on its way to becoming something else. Huh?
I mean, by
well,
criteria.
That's right. But it's more of a common sense. I see your question. More of a common sense. Descriptive.
So along those lines, one can say that the eye can get, through a period of time, can get better, but it can't turn into anything other than an eye.
Right. No, I would never do it, because the eye, what the eye is determined, is governed by and limited by the amount of genetic information that allowed the cellular division to create the eye. But only the information is there. Create nothing less than it might break down and create a defective eye. They'll never create anything more than that, beyond the limits. There'll be different colors of eye, there'll be great variety, different sizes. It's like a floppy disk in a computer. I can put a syllabus on a floppy disk. And I might hit a wrong button, or I might get a magnet too close to the disk and mess up the information. So when I do a printout on it, what I get is a messed up form of my syllabus. Understand? If I got the syllabus studio, the floppy disk studio, or not a magnet. Okay, but I am not going to accidentally, I'm not going to get the syllabus near a magnet and accidentally get an improvement on my syllabus. Get a few footnotes that I've been, of books I've never read. get a revised outline that's superior to the one I had. You see, any change represents a loss of information, and any mutation through radiation or something represents a loss of information, not the increase. So it may be less than that, but it may be more than the syllabus. Before I get something more, I have to have an intelligent process whereby I put more information in. And that's not just a now, that's good. That's the nature of the case.
I was just going to say, couldn't it, if you get a magnet close to the disk, couldn't it change it into another certain book, so to speak, that you have read, but I guess it's impossible to read that before?
No. Well, yes. As a matter of fact, it's impossible. You can say, well, it could happen. But not really. And there's no evidence that it ever did happen. It's all good.
Well, anyway, how do we get then from micro, how does neo-Darwinism get from micro to macro? The answer is extrapolation, mathematical extrapolation. What is extrapolation? Give me an example of extrapolation, not necessarily an evolution. Give me an example of extrapolation. Simple extrapolation, the process. Do you understand fairly what this word means?
Student enrollment, say, 5 years ago, it was, say, 100
insurance employees, so 5 years ago, it would be 34. Yeah, we extrapolate. Or I can simply say this. It takes me 4 seconds to walk 15 feet. If I continue walking at the same rate for 8 seconds, how far down the road will I be?
30.
Simple extrapolation. If I continue at the same rate for 4 hours, you can extrapolate, so this is how far we'll be. That's simple extrapolation. Now, what they say is, but it is mathematical extrapolation. That is, what the standard answer was, that if we extrapolate microevolution, we will get macroevolution.
What was the reason behind it? What was the logic behind it?
Because there is no evidence. You cannot get it by looking anything observable. You cannot. There is nothing in the fossil record that shows the transition from micro to macro. See, without macro, you don't really have evolution. Not in this.
They're just fishing.
Well, yes. But it says that is what they did is you can compute the rate of microevolution and extrapolate it to transition to macro. Now, what is the problem with this? Now, this is how it's done. It's mathematical. Note this. And if you look at the text, I can bring you the text to show you that whereas instead of showing fossil evidence, they show mathematical equations. Instead of showing laboratory examples of the observed transition, you get, in other words, in the place of either fossil evidence or biologic evidence, that is, evidence of forms that have lived in the past, or evidence of forms that live in the future, in the transition, what they do is they fill the textbooks with two things. Examples, this, just check this out, I'm not making this up. They fill the textbooks with examples of microevolution plus mathematical computation, mathematical formulae, and get megaevolution or macroevolution. That is the method. Yes?
Wouldn't many evolutionists, though, not admit that they were extrapolating, or rather say they were going from, they were interpolating, they were going from, because they have this form out here that's further developed. So this is one point here, and then we have this one that's not as developed. So you do have the end points, and there has to be something.
Well, no, they admit that, there's no question. Nobody who would know, certainly would deny this. In fact, one of the big complaints among biologists now is, I've heard them say this, well, the problem with being a biologist anymore is you can't be a biologist, you've got to be a mathematician. Biology is becoming math. Whereas, if only you can't see the observed forms or observed fossils, you've got to compute. And they're admitting this. In fact, G. C. Lawrence Grace, in his book on anthropology, who's a devout evolutionist, and I really mean devout in the religious sense of that term, he expresses his alarm. He says, but you know, the problem is, some of our students are showing more confidence in the mathematics and they're forgetting the biological forms. That is, they're simply saying, oh, we know evolution's true, let me work it out for you mathematically.
Well, I'm saying, though, would they claim that it was interpolation instead of extrapolation?
No, because you interpolate by extrapolation. They're filling in the gaps by this method.
They don't use as proof that there has to be a transitional form, the fact that there is the existence of a form that's been developed.
I'm sorry?
Okay. To say that there, okay, we know there has to be a transitional form because we see that there is. Come out of the other end here and enhance this further development.
Well, they argue philosophically that the transitional forms, there must have been a transition. But the question is how that transition, that's what we're going to come to that later. That's being revised. What is being revised is how, but no one denies there were some kind of transitional forms. There had to be. And since we don't find it in the fossil record, then we will show their likelihood by extrapolating mathematically, not by of course, really, that's a redundancy because extrapolation is a mathematical process. So if we're simply extrapolate macro from the known rate of microevolution. No, they would not say I'm misrepresenting. In fact, they criticize one another and themselves among themselves on this very point. Now the problem with mathematical extrapolation, let's forget the mathematics, is redundancy. Is everyone following this discussion? There are two problems with it. First problem is the problem of simple probability. Simple probability. That is, what are the odds of this happening?
They would seem very good because it obviously did, wouldn't they?
No.
No, they would admit that the odds were, that's why they need so much time. The odds are heavily against us. But what they did, they went on until the 1960s, they went on very blindly, filling their biology text with mathematical equations, until there was a meeting called in Philadelphia at the Wistar Institute. By the way, the results of this have been published. You got a copy in our library. I've got it on the open stack because it's such a valuable document. It's called the Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism. It was held at the Wistar Institute. And what happens is the mathematicians led by Murray Eden at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and others. But the mathematicians called the biologists to a meeting in Philadelphia, the Wistar Institute, at a symposium. It's been published. It's called Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism. And they said to you, fellas, your math is very nice, but it's got a problem with it. It does not work. That is, your mathematical equations are good math, but they do not represent biological reality. And the main problem is probabilities. That is, because we know about probability. See, before the 60s, they can put this math down, but you see, now we have computers who can run these things through in comparison to known biological realities and show that they will not work. That is, your math doesn't work, fellas, because in the areas of probabilities. And Murray Eden simply said, Neil, you thought they weren't arguing for creationism. Creationism had nothing to do with it. Creationism never came up. All they're saying is that your math is defective because, as a matter of fact, the chances of this happening are not infinite. But they, for instance, they would admit that the chances of they had to admit that the chances of any one of several million required changes taking place where you get added information, like the computer disk being scarred, producing more information. What are the chances of me running a magnet over my computer floppy disk, putting it in, and getting a vastly improved syllabus? Those of books I haven't read yet, books of that I haven't read. The chance, could it happen? Well, you might say, if you did it enough times? It was the old monkey typewriter argument. You see, they say you do one in 10 raised to the power of 160 or something, or 16,000. Yeah, so they were getting numbers like that in their mathematical equations. And a mathematician who studied probabilities, and these probabilities, the mathematics of probabilities, the former estimates now can be worked out because we do high-speed computers. And they've been doing this, and they know now that one in 10 raised to the power of 50, you go beyond that, and you're simply talking. They're just not, you can say it's possible, but it isn't. Probability has become impossibility, and really long before that. So they're simply saying your problem of probability. That's why on this basis, for instance, I'm going to show you later. This is the reason the guy, the steady state theory man, who wrote the Intelligent Universe, Hoyle. He's the one, not a creationist. He's the one who said the chances of this happening are the many significant changes, not all the changes, but one of the many required changes for any biological form are the chances of a tornado going through a junkyard and assembling a Boeing 747. And what he said was, listen to me, he said that not only is it impossible, you know, the chance it's not the chance. That was his language. Got that, the chance of a tornado going through a junkyard and constructing a Boeing 747 with all serial numbers there, the radar system, the tape music for you to play, complete with cocktails. He said not only could that not happen, he said it wouldn't happen if you fill the universe with tornadoes and junkyards. There's not enough computable time. So he just bailed out. And then the other guy had. Well, my point is that the mathematicians sent to the biologists You fellows need to come down off out of your theoretical world and know, are you with me? That you're,
this is what the Wistar Institute was said. Murray Eden from MIT and others pointed out, you can read it. What they said was, in effect, your mathematics do not represent biological reality. Now, this mathematics is still in the textbooks. Dobation is still being taught. You see that? The problem of probabilities, the old monkey in the typewriter. But the guy who said that, his famous statement, you know, the tornado through the junkyard, he was not a creationist. He's one of the world's, he was Britain's leading astronomer, one of the world's top astrophysicists. And a whole chorus of the joining in said, fellas, it simply won't work. The second problem of this, using, of extrapolating, but to get extrapolating micro into macro, is general into special. I'm special if this is special evolution. And this is general evolution. It's a problem of gradualism. That is, what is, and I learned this, this is very simple. You can take a number and break it down into an almost infinite number, infinitely small fractions. You can take a number and break it down to an infinitely small fraction. That is, you can take one and divide it by two, or you can divide it by four and get smaller parts. Or you can divide it by 8 and get a smaller part, or by 16 or 30 seconds, or you can divide it into a millionth, or 10 millionths, or billions, or 100 billions, and you can go on infinitely because theoretically you never run out of numbers. So you can break something down mathematically to an infinite number of small parts, and what the mathematicians were doing, what the biologists were doing, was using math to break down these, to represent these tiny increments that neo-Darwinism required, tiny, tiny mutational changes, which over vast periods of time would accumulate into major changes, mega-evolution. They were representing these micro-changes as mathematical fractions. And it's very convenient because you can compute it, you can get the tiny fractions. The problem is that while gradualism will work in mathematics, it will not work in biological forms, and I've already addressed this in my discussion of pre-adaptation. That is, you can take tiny, you can make your choice, you can break numbers down into as small parts as you want, add them together and get one, right? You can take billions and add them together and get one. You can take 100 billions, add them together one at a time until you get one. And it's good mathematics. It does not work in the biological world. Why? Because in the biological world, you cannot put together forms a millionth part at a time, or a hundredth part at a time, or three parts at a time, or two parts at a time. Remember my rattlesnake? Right, what is a rattlesnake? It's math. Of course, it's got a heat sensor system in its. That's how it hunts its prey. It can't see with a nickel. It finds its prey by heat sensor. It's more sensitive than anything that rocket science ever built. It finds it detects warm bodies. And it's got a very sophisticated chemical that breaks down proteins in the muscles and paralyzes. You know, that's how the rattlesnake kills. It suffocates. It breaks down the protein molecules in the muscles fix, the muscles in the lungs can't breathe, the animal dies. Very complicated. And it's got a very nice, it's got a hypodermic delivery system. Now, somebody explain to me how that could be developed gradually. Explain to me half of that. We're going to talk math. Let's be very generous. Let's not talk about millions. Let's talk about halves. Somebody just imagine for me. I don't want to see a fossil evidence, but you know, Mike. Somebody give me a fossil. Somebody just imagine half of that being present. Well, you've got the, let's say you've got,
so you've got the heat without the
pressure. Or say you've got, you got half the chemical and half the tooth. But you see, the chemical is very sophisticated. Was there a creature born that had, was there a creature at some time lived underground, we're told, a lizard, went underground, lost its legs, that had no poison? See, most lizards don't have any. And its son
was born, that the offspring was born, that the sacs, all the complicated apparatus to have the poison system in its jaws. Fortunately, because you got to have somebody else down the road that has a little girl with it too, so they can maybe have offspring, but we'll forget that. That's the very thing. And she said, "Doesn't do good. The problem is, doesn't do any good just to get one. But y'all know how that works, don't you? You know about steamed up things. Anyway, now, so what good of it? Are we to believe that? Or you said, how did the offspring have something on its way to being a very sophisticated poison? And what good is the poison of the delivery system? See, and the first is the tooth of the snake, the hole has to go all the way through it the first time. That's no good. It doesn't function. You see, I can go on and on. That is, in the biological world, you cannot, gradualism simply is a myth. Because what we see in the biological world cannot be produced gradually. Now we're going to see what I'm just talking about neo-Darwinists now. These are the objections that are being, on this basis, primarily as others, we're going to see that this is why the biologists themselves are now abandoning neo-Darwinism, except in the textbooks. I'll tell you what their answer is. But you understand the problem? This is the form it took. That's the problem of extrapolation, probability and gradualism. Doesn't work. Because, now it gets more complicated, but those are the basic problems. Well, do you understand the nature of the argument, first of all? Extrapolation from micro to macro, mathematically, and the problems involved in it. I'm putting this very simplest form. Now, by the way, I'll give you an example. I mentioned here Goldschmidt, flip over to the next page. Goldschmidt. One of the leaders in evolution, look at number two. The neo-Darwinists claim the accumulation of gene mutations and isolation, I'm on 21.2, the selection of new variants that continue to undergo the same process account for all the evolutionary diversification. Goldschmidt, this is about 1940, he's from the University of California, biologist, in his book, The Material Basis of Evolution, challenged the concept of gradualism. Now keep in mind, here are two great challenges. Even before the mathematicians at the Wistar Institute challenged the mathematics in terms of probabilities, got that? Goldschmidt, back in 1940, not a creationist, challenged the concept of gradualism. Here's what he said. He challenged neo-Darwinists to explain, not show evidence for, there was no evidence, no either biological or pedagogical, living or present or past, the evolution of 18 features by the accumulation of small mutations. Got this? Here's what he said. He said, fellas, let's be honest. We're talking about gradual accumulation of small changes into large changes. It's in all the textbooks, still is. He said, let's do this. Let's just imagine, explain to me how these 18 very simple forms could have developed gradually. Understand? Don't show me evidence that they did. That's asking too much. Just explain how it could have happened. Be hypothetical. Got that? He said, and he picked these 18. Here's what he listed. His 18 included hair in mammals. That's pretty simple. Feathers in birds, segmentation of arthropods and vertebrates, visceral arches, muscles, nerves, teeth, shells of mollusks, ectoskeletons, insects that are scum on the outside, ectoskeletons, compound eyes, blood circulation, and alternation of generations. He said, fellas, before we go, this is back in 1940 now. He says, fellas, see, what was the period of agnosticism? 1900 to 1925. Well, they had a happy time discrediting creationists and saying, now we know we got it all worked out. But 1940, what they said is, we got the system worked out, we can show you mathematically, and we're going to find the fossil evidence for long. Did they find the fossil evidence? No.
Finally, Goldsmith, keep in mind, not a Christian, said, fellas, before we go any further with this, before we, we aren't finding the fossil evidence, let's just talk about how it might have happened. So he challenged the scientific community just to explain, hypothetically, how these different biological forms could have come about gradually. What was the response of the scientific community? Absolute silence. He gave him a chance. He said, somebody just tell me how they could have. Complete silence. Nobody even tried. So, he said, okay, since we're all agreed that we're looking for fossils, we're promising that we're going to find fossils for something that could never have even occurred anyway, he came out for what is called emergent evolution. What is the hopeful monster? What he said is that all these tiny mutations, which are supposed, he said, change, mega evolution, as it's called now, let's call it back then, or macro evolution, big evolution, general evolution. Now hear me. He says, since we all know now, since you've admitted by your silence, that these things did not come about gradually, all these infinitely small mutations, and since we believe in evolution, without creation, he said, we're going to have to think a new way, and let's think this way, that over all this vast time, these millions and millions of years, every once in a while there would be not a tiny mutation, but a huge mutation. Now we know by the nature of mutations that every mutation we've ever seen has been degenerative, negative. We're going to have to say that yes, but in all this vast time, a tiny fraction of these big mutations, huge changes, you're going to get one that's not only going to be positive, or it's going to add genetic information somehow. That if you pass the magnet over to this, enough time you're going to get citations of what you haven't read yet. And that these would be, these would comport with the environment and they would reproduce and go on. That is, and he calls it the hopeful monster. The monster is a technical term meaning this huge change. Most monsters were mutations which died and were sterile and were not productive and progressive. But we're going to talk, one of these will be a hopeful monster. Be a good monster, a good change. So what he said in effect was, fellas, we've talked about the gradual transition. I'm just telling you what he said. Fellas, he's talking to his fellow Neil Darwinists. He says, fellas, we have talked for years about theoretically the gradual transition from a whole-blooded reptile to a warm-blooded bird. Let's admit that it is impossible for a cold-blooded reptile to gradually evolve into a warm-blooded bird. So let's just admit that one day a reptile, cold-blooded reptile in an egg, and hatched a warm-blooded bird. And on that premises, not too far away, another cold-blooded reptile has another warm-blooded bird for this warm-blooded bird to marry. It takes two to tango. Evolution does not progress where you don't have any youngins. You all know that. You got that? And now what is your reaction to that? What is your reaction? Suppose somebody said, well, a cold-blooded reptile has been that has a warm-blooded bird. Now, it wasn't like a modern bird, just to be fair. It was a bird-like cold-blooded reptile. Has to be a reptile-like cold-blooded bird. We don't have any fossil evidence, but let's just say it happened. What was your reaction to that? What he's saying is, let's just admit that the reason that we aren't, let's just admit that we aren't going to find the transitional forms, and the reason we hadn't found the transitional forms is they were never there. Fewer transitional forms. What would you say about that? Well, what I would say about that is that's crazy. Which is exactly what the community said. The Neo-Darwinist community said, he's crazy. He said, I lost his academic reputation. He said, I'm crazy, huh? You come up with something better. At least explain to me how these forms could have. And they answered him not. They just ridiculed him and went on their happy Neo-Darwinian way. Now, the whole world is saying we're getting back together. That in the last 7 years, in the late 70s, somebody else, and Goldschmidt died in disrepute. But we're going to see that with Niles Eldridge and Jay Gould, that once more, Goldschmidt lives. What I want us to see, the problem with neo-Darwinism and the fact that these issues have been raised, gradualism and probabilities. Now listen to me, one more point, I'll let you go. You understand that even if the neo-Darwinist consolidates, he has not touched the greater problem.